Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the emerging uses of virtual reality to begin the show today. Back with us, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. So we'll talk with Jesse about this new technology, how it's being used and how it can help you, and maybe some cautions as well as we move along. And of course, take your questions about virtual reality and other questions as well. You may have some other tech questions that you want to bring up, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good to be here.
Let's start at the very basics. Explain, what is virtual reality?
Yeah, well, and right now, I think everyone, at least when I was first introduced to this, virtual reality was what I had heard. But now we have all these other things, augmented reality, mixed reality, extended reality. I'm going to go with one of the newest terms they have right now, which is extended reality, XR. That's basically a different name to reference all of these other terms that we're thinking about.
Okay.
So it's kind of an umbrella term for all of it. Virtual reality, which I know I was a little bit more used to, is when you're kind of immersed into a different reality. So it's not using the environment around you. You're put into a different reality and are in an immersive experience. So, you know, video games, when you have full headsets, sound, you're somewhere else. It really is not being in your existing environment. That's really the virtual reality. Then we have augmented reality, which is trying to put some information on top of the reality that you're currently in. So your day-to-day life. I think most people definitely saw this with a very, very popular mobile game, Pokemon Go, where you're taking a cell phone around town and you're actually finding these creatures, these Pokemon, in your real world life. So you're augmenting your existing reality with this kind of superimposed reality on top of it. So it's putting some additional data on there. And then mixed reality is kind of putting both of those together in new and different ways, where you're kind of combining the virtual reality and the augmented reality that you might have for, you know, whether it's a gaming experience or, you know, maybe you're using Google Maps with the augmented reality view, where you're showing with your camera the physical world around you, but also getting instructions on potentially where to turn if you're walking through the streets. And that extended reality is just any of these things is extended reality, but you might be using it in a variety of different ways, depending on how, I guess, connected or disconnected you are from your day-to-day world around you.
And it's even, is it not, let's say when I want to go on to my bank account, I hold my phone up and it looks at my face and does a facial recognition. Is that part of the virtual reality as well?
I'd say from like what they call like the biometrics, so proving who you are or authenticating using, you know, your face, using your thumbprint. Generally, I'd consider that separate. So that's like an authentication using a factor with a biometric rather than what they say is a what you know, which is a password.
Okay.
So you can prove kind of who you are from what you know, what you are, or maybe even what you have. So if you ever had a multi-factor or two-factor authentication prompt on your mobile device where you have data prove, that's kind of an example of that what you have factor. Interestingly enough, while that's really not necessarily what augmented reality or extended reality might be, there's an interesting overlap because that actually has been an interesting conversation in terms of privacy with some of these items. But you also might have to authenticate yourself in an extended reality environment, potentially using emotion or doing a certain physical act that would say, this is who I am, and it's unique to me. But that brings up a whole lot of other interesting privacy questions as well.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, certainly gaming, and you know, I haven't even tried it yet. None of my friends have it, so I haven't had a chance to try it out myself. But so that you know, but the gaming and the kind of fun part is certainly sounds, you know, it's pretty cool. Like, but how is XR being used by business, for example? Are they using it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the one business we probably use all the time without really thinking of it maybe as a business is Google. So Google's using it quite a bit. We see it in Google Maps pretty much every day. So whether you're using the augmented reality view for streets, for directions, or something else, it's definitely in use a variety of different ways. We are using especially cell phones in many ways to interact with the outside world and potentially add context to it. One might be, I actually like Google Translate. I would consider that kind of an augmented reality where I'm getting translations of a text in real time when I don't actually know the language. So I'm getting this data fed to me based upon what's on the screen in the real world. And so those are some examples, but it definitely extends to simulating kind of our real world in new and interesting ways. You know, we've all heard of flight simulators, or at least many of us have. We've seen it for quite some time. Whether it's these boxes you might see in a mall where you're actually physically in like a cockpit, or you're playing a video game where you might see a monitor, but you can actually do it very, very differently where you actually have other hardware for extended or augmented reality where you're actually being able to simulate things. And I think that simulation where you're interacting maybe with some things that are in the physical environment, but some things that are not, opens up a variety of new ways to teach and to learn. If you are trying to learn how to perform surgery, it's very unlikely there's going to be a real person in front of you that you are going to be simply performing surgery on. But the ability to simulate that in a way with extended reality hardware and other technology really opens up how to learn in a little bit more practical way that otherwise just really isn't possible. So, you know, finding new ways to get into a situation which otherwise just aren't possible is a really interesting use case for extended reality.
Yeah, it's all pretty darn cool if you ask me. And in terms of the learning, as an educator, somebody who's taught for a long, long time, I could see so many practical ways. You mentioned the medical. I've also read that it's quite useful for learning a new language, that it can work well for that and probably many other uses.
Yeah, and I think right now there's so many excellent use cases being used right now for extended reality. And I think it's just starting. So I think there's going to be quite a few more different ways to think about how to use extended reality to learn and to do new and different things. I even think about being in a studio and seeing this huge soundboard. I have no idea what all these buttons are, but imagine you can see this and actually get context-driven clues about what these buttons do, and you can move it and change things in a new and interesting way to find out what it does. Which offers a little bit more safety, especially in learning, because you need that environment to be able to try something, to do it wrong, frankly, and then to learn from it and find out how to do it better in the future. So it's really interesting to be able to do that. And you get all this wonderful data fed to you that otherwise is really challenging to understand. You have to do a lot of research, you have to talk to more people, which are always going to be things we need, but it offers a really great way to get more immediate feedback and to learn, hopefully, in a new way that would otherwise be challenging. You can only have so many people coming with you everywhere you go, but if you have your cell phone or if you have other technology, it really opens up to learning pretty much really wherever and whenever you want to.
I even read somewhere where, I mean, just looking down the road on this, that it may be possible for physicians to do surgeries when they're not even present with the person. And I don't know how that happens. But I guess I could see cameras on the person, and I don't know if it's robotics or what it would be, but it sounds kind of scary in a way.
Yeah. And I mean, right now, to an extent that exists today with a variety of different technologies and maybe the surgeons in the room, but with the right infrastructure, they could really be anywhere. And that's one of the items, you know, with extended reality that's crucial, is what they call latency. So making sure you have this infrastructure that allows you to do it in a great way. So, you know, high speed internet, equipment that is responsive. Having somebody in the same room makes it a lot easier because a lot of those challenges go away. But if you want to be able to do that, let's say the surgeon's halfway around the world, you need all those other pieces to work well, because you really do need that immediate feedback, and you need to make sure that what you're seeing is as close to real time as possible. Because especially in the surgery, it's a life safety situation. You want to make sure that everything is accurate, so you're getting the right data. But you know, it's an interesting new way to do it, where you know you're really being able to control these devices rather than using your own hands or you know, fingers to take certain movements. So it's very interesting.
Is, you know, you mentioned, I think, in passing, privacy, but what's the, there's probably some privacy issues with this whole business.
Yeah, there's a few, mainly just because there's a variety of data that's being collected by these devices. Even thinking about the augmented reality is the one I always think of first. You have these people, you know, they're playing a game around the world, using their cell phones to find, let's say Pokemon, but it could really be anything. Maybe it's Google Maps view. But imagine all the objects, the people, the vehicles, the houses that you're also capturing along with your phone without even really thinking about it. You may be thinking about, I need to get from point A to point B, but may not be thinking all of these people that happen to be passing my camera's field of view. What happens to that data? Is it recorded? Is it saved? What else happens with that information? And so that's, you know, definitely a concern from really any third party, any individual out in the world. If somebody else is using this technology, what does that mean for my privacy? Because, you know, I might be in a certain location. I may not want others to know, but it could be captured really without intent by somebody else and actually stored and used somewhere. And so that's, you know, that's one of the many concerns, but especially with the headsets and the interactive capabilities of extended reality, they also might be recording your surroundings, how you're moving with a device. And I was also reading an article where just how you interact with the world and with these different sensors potentially on your body, you might actually be able to be identified based upon how unique your movements are. So even if some of this data may be what they call de-identified, so your name's removed, it's just a series of data points. That data, especially combined with other sources of data, may actually be able to be used to identify you. So that could be another potential risk. Is an extended reality hardware user, while it's de-identified, your data might be out there, people may be using it, and they could use it for something else. So your own privacy becomes questioned as just a standard edge user as well.
Jesse LeGrue, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group, started the show today by talking about virtual reality, and we can continue with that. If you have questions about that, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. And if you have other tech questions, I hope you'll join us as well. Again, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau's our producer today. Clara Neipert, our on-air producer, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Jesse LeGrew of Madison College's Technology Services Group. Comes by every couple of months to talk with us about what's going on in the world of technology. Started looking at virtual reality technology today, and certainly if you have questions about that, I hope you'll join in. Or other questions about other issues that you may have in the tech area. Again, 800-642-1234, email to ideas at WPR.org. Does it make sense to, I don't know, stay away from these technologies or kind of watch what happens with them and until some of, for example, some of these privacy issues are resolved?
I think it really depends on individuals or company's risk profile. So, you know, if you have something that's really, really sensitive and you want to make sure that the privacy is at a maximum, there are ways to do that with existing technology now. But it always depends on really how you're using the technology, where that data is being stored, and what kind of risk there is. Any new technology, there's always kind of a new risk that pops up. Some of those we actually don't know about till years afterward because we just never quite thought of exactly how some of this information or technology could be used. It's always the strange security answer. It depends. Yeah. So it depends on who you are and what you need the technology to do and what data you're supplying to it. If you know you do have a large need to maintain privacy, there's a variety of things to think about when using that technology. But sometimes the only way to really learn is to kind of dive into it and start using it to see where some of those challenges might be to find new solutions to it. So I definitely won't say don't use it because it's scary and your data may be everywhere. That is kind of the challenge with a lot of our technology these days is all of it's collecting data on us, our web browsers, whether it's ads or something else. Those data collection points are always there. But there are some things you can do to at least minimize some of the risk. The terms and conditions can be a big one, but no one loves reading those terms and conditions. It's a lot of words.
Well, I think, the other thing, as you kind of mentioned in passing, was the amount. I mean, you need high-speed computer. You need, up-to-date computers. And I guess there could be some, there would be issues. I'm almost positive. Certain areas where, those things just aren't there, you're kind of behind the eight ball a little bit.
Yeah, and it does depend on exactly what kind of extended reality you're using. Let's say it was an augmented reality for a mapping application. It might still work well if you can download some of the data offline, and it could still kind of feed you that information as you need it. But for real-time applications, especially when working with others, having that high-speed connection is really, really important. And so as, we continue to think about our, networking infrastructure really throughout the world, being able to make sure everyone has that capability. And a lot of these services are delivered with an equitable mindset, I think is important. That's also the case just with this technology itself. You're going to get a different experience if you use one type of hardware versus another. Not everyone has a really brand new updated PC with the latest hardware that they can use because it's an expense. Same thing with any of these dedicated hardware that you might get that don't need a computer. The more money you have, usually the better capability. Not everyone has those kind of resources available. So that equity imbalance can create challenges as well.
Yeah. Joanna in Appleton has a question not relating to this, but something else. And let's go ahead and take it. It's an email. And she says she uses Webroot Webroot. But they reported to her that she has two infections. Should Joanne be purchasing another product to clean her laptop? The next report then said she had no threats.
That's a good question. So it probably depends on what it finds. I've not used Webroot myself. It's possible within that first identification that it actually did remove it. One other possibility, depending on what it found, it actually simply might not be there because you closed a web browser or closed an open tab. So the possibility of simply just not being on that website, assuming that's where it kind of came from, might have actually resolved the issue itself. So just not being there could have solved it. I always do like using a different product if I'm not quite sure of the information that I'm getting. I've used Super Anti-Spyware in the past. I believe that's free for personal use to install and run on your computer. It'll at least give an additional set of information to say, did it find the same thing? Is it finding nothing? It'll at least give you an idea of what may be on your computer. And there's others out there, but I've used that. I've used SpyBot has been another, I think, common one. I believe that's still free for personal use. But validating with another tool is good. Just be very careful about the tool that you're using, because there are a lot of fake antivirus programs that are out there. So even if it's kind of a Google search and a click away for potentially going to a bad place, but Super Anti-Spyware and SpyBot Search and Destroy have been and two tools that I've used in the past to kind of find similar data, and it might help in this case as well.
Veronica emailed as well. Her Bluetooth printer is offline, and how does she go about getting her PC to recognize it again? She's having difficulty with that.
It's a good question. So my first answer will always be the standard technical answer, which is just turn everything off and turn it back on again. So including the printer and the computer, just to make sure everything comes up fresh, and hopefully you can try to reconnect at that point as well. Most of the Bluetooth printers that you get will usually have a control panel on the screen that allows you to change certain settings. It might also allow you to turn on or turn off Bluetooth, or give you a status page that will just confirm, yes, it's turned on and yes, it's functioning. So I would check the manual just to verify that Bluetooth is turned on for your printer, and to verify what those settings are. On your computer, you can also just make sure your Bluetooth is turned on, because you can also turn Bluetooth off on your device. And that the name it reflects for the network is the same as the name you see on that status indicator from the printer itself. Worst case, what I might do for a Bluetooth device I have an issue with, I'll go to my Bluetooth devices. I will remove the device that I know isn't working, and I will try to add it back. There's usually a Bluetooth pairing mode that you can turn on for your printer. Once you've deleted and try to add it back to your device, it should hopefully detect it. You can reinstall it, and it'll work again. So there's no issue if you need to delete it and recreate it. It won't break anything, but hopefully it'll allow you to reconnect that printer. And after that, you can go ahead and print like normal.
Our guest today, Jesse LeGrew, talking with him about virtual reality, but we've switched into some sort of, not standard, but somewhat standard, sometimes unusual technology questions. And if you have something going on with your computer or your software, maybe your phone, you can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. I was talking with a friend whose daughter is going to be going to college in the fall for the first time. I had that same issue myself a year ago with daughter Emily. And this was a question about computers and, you know, what does a college student need for a computer, a new one? The one that I guess she used was because more or less a simple one that the high schools that her high school had. And now she needs a new something new.
Yeah. And part of it really does depend, too, on the program that you're going into. And the schools usually have a recommendation. Also, some colleges and universities may also either provide hardware or have it throughout the program. So the first thing I'd always do, check with, you know, your college or university, because they might state, hey, we have these 10 programs. This is the device we recommend for each one of them. And I've seen that before at different institutions. For some college students, a Chromebook might be perfect. You're writing a lot of papers. You just need the basics. Chromebooks are relatively inexpensive, definitely for word processing and a variety of the just day-to-day things that we do with spreadsheets, word processing, and other things, email. They work completely fine. And there's a lot of different applications available that you can easily install and get up and running really quickly. But you also might have somebody else that not only, you know, wants to, you know, use college resources, they want their own powerful computer to run all the software that they have for their program on their device. That's usually very, very different and can go to the completely other end of the spectrum where, you know, they're spending thousands of dollars on a device, but also actually might need to even spend thousands of dollars to even get that software installed on their computer. Because even with academic discounts, some of the programs can still be relatively expensive. So it definitely depends. There's definitely a scale. When I talk to people about just buying a general computer, I always recommend get a solid state hard drive if you can. They're just going to give you a little bit better performance. Make sure you have enough storage for the next, let's say, 5 years. So it's never good to run out of storage space. And with a lot of new computers these days, they can't be upgraded. So you need to think about it before you buy it. And then memory is another thing I usually recommend taking a look at. I think right now I'd recommend probably 16 gigabytes of memory, depending on what operating system you're running on. But the more memory or RAM that your computer has, the faster programs run, because that's actually what happens when you try to run an application. It loads it from the hard drive into memory, and then it runs from there. So the more space you have, generally, the faster things are going to run. Outside of that, there are a lot of different options. But your educational institution may also give you software and or hardware discounts, which is another reason I recommend taking a look, because you might not be able to get it in another way very easily. So definitely check with where anyone's going to school to see what they offer. And then you can kind of go from there. And there may or may not be recommendations for the specific program, but that's at least a starting point to find out what hardware might be needed, because there are a lot of options and you can pick 10 options and they can all work. You just want to make sure you don't get something that doesn't have enough for you. It's nice to have that room once you buy hardware. But, you know, that being said, there's a very small amount of individuals that are going to need to spend, you know, $3,000 on a brand new powerful laptop. I'm guessing most end users or students are going to be fine with, you know, $1,000 laptop or even a Chromebook that's significantly less to get their day-to-day work done.
I was just thinking about that. I think I was on the upper end of that scale more toward. I was looking, just with the major that she has, the software and everything requirements, and I'm thinking about something that will last 4 years anyway, and still have the memory and everything that she needs. I think it was more like $2,800 or something like that for daughter Emily's computer, which I have certainly hope will last 4 years.
Yeah, and another item to think about too is those times away from school. So a lot of times the computer becomes a device for leisure as well. So making sure you have that capability, maybe somebody likes gaming, for example. So having it so you have that capability built in, or at least a thought about it, maybe you have a second device. But laptops are also more expensive than desktops. So, you know, do you need the mobility or can you get away with a desktop that's sitting in one place all the time? That can be a challenge. I bought a laptop my freshman year, which was two decades ago. So I bought it. And I intended to take it to class, never really did. It became more of a desktop than anything. So while it was kind of nice to have the mobility, most of the time it didn't move around. So it's another thing to keep in mind. You know, you might get the benefit, you might not, but sometimes you just don't know until you start. So you only have the data you have with today. So at least, you know, build in enough flexibility so you don't lock yourself into a decision that might make you buy another thing a year or two down the road.
Let's take a call. By the way, you can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions. Kurt in Columbia County, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, Larry and guests. Thank you. My story is I recently purchased a photo software program, and my home computer DSL line is too slow to download it. So I've gone to a couple libraries to download about a 90-megabyte file and onto a flash drive. And while at the library with the computer downloading sitting idle, the computer shuts down before the download is complete. Any suggestions on how I can keep that going for maybe a 15, 20-minute period of time to complete the download? Otherwise, I tried twice, and I get an incomplete file. I bring it home. It doesn't work at all because it's incomplete. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, and so there's a couple different reasons it could be timing out. One is just because there's no activity with a keyboard or mouse. Do you normally get a disconnect where it either logs out of the computer or do you get a specific message when it times out?
No, I don't. It just kind of goes to the default screen, you know, the wallpaper. And I click on something or hit a keystroke to get up the screen again, and I lost the connection. I did not ask the people at the desk what's going on, but I could do that next time, I suppose.
Yeah, and from what it sounds like kind of it's a standard like screensaver or login timeout. You know, most computers have it where after a certain amount of inactivity, it either logs off or it kind of disconnects. One of the old ways to go about resolving that, keep your hand on the mouse, just move your mouse around until the download is finished. And it will hopefully stop it from disconnecting and logging out or going to that lock screen. It depends on kind of what that login timeout is, but usually that mouse activity, it's looking for mouse or keyboard activity in a certain time frame. If it doesn't get it, it's going to log out or lock your screen. So that would be one recommendation I'd have to try. But as you noted, I'd also recommend talking to the front desk. They can at least give you some additional information or a suggestion to make sure that the download completes. They might also have other software that's causing an issue, but they would definitely be able to at least give you some more information on what the problem might be. But if it is a screensaver timeout, I do this where it might be every 15 minutes on my computer, and I will take my hand and I will just tap my mouse just to make sure it doesn't time out. That might be a good workaround for you, assuming that it's the same problem.
Yeah, I would bet. And the librarians probably know how long that length of time is before shutdown, I'm guessing. Or they could even adjust that, can't they? You're able to adjust that in a individual computer.
Yeah, and it depends on kind of the library and the resources they have there. They might be able to change it, they might not. So it's hard to know. If it is that screensaver timeout, tapping the mouse every now and again should reset that timer so that it doesn't log out on you. But you'll need to kind of remain there and active for that time period while it's downloading.
Yeah, good luck, Kurt. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott from Windsor sent us an email. Scott's seen numerous offers in his social network on Facebook recently for MS Office, complete suite, lifetime license at absurdly low prices, as low as $20 or so. And he presumes these deals are scams. And if so, what's the catch? What's going on there? Do you know?
That is a really good question. One thing I always take a look at with any kind of ads that pop up, and it's hard to know because the source is really challenging. One thing I always do if I am not sure about an ad and how legitimate it might be, I'll actually Google it just to see if I get the same results. In this case, hopefully from Microsoft, because usually you're going to be going through Microsoft or through a reseller to purchase Office. And actually, the subscriptions for a personal use of Microsoft 365 is actually pretty inexpensive for an individual user or even for a family plan. And usually those are going to be either annual or monthly subscriptions, because most of it you're kind of using either on the web or you're going to download your local copy. So I actually recommend trying to Google it to see what you might get. But otherwise, go directly to Microsoft's site. If it is, you know, a regular cost, maybe there is a discount through a third party. But see what the cost is there. See what the difference is. Maybe it's monthly instead of annually. Or if you do notice in the ad, they might also have a coupon code. Usually you can use that in the Microsoft store as well. It may be valid is basically the short answer. But it's I would also do a little bit of research just to try and validate, are you getting the right information and where is it coming from? It may tell you where it's coming from. It may not. Usually they're getting a little bit better about ads that are false and actually getting those removed, or at the very least getting them tagged with, this might be, you know, inaccurate information. So, hopefully that will get cleared out. But I would take a look, at Microsoft's site to verify.
Our guest today, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Do you have an IT question, problem that you're dealing with, or question about software or your computers? I hope you'll join in. Phones, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about technology on the show with our guest, Jesse LeGrew. Great to have him back. He's Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He helps design, develop, and implement security standards and protocols. Questions for him? We're kind of quiet today. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Susan sent an email wondering if a relatively high local demand can affect mobile data service. She had trouble in Madison over the weekend with service, and she wondered if the art fair on the square caused this. Lots of people on their phones outside, everybody taking pictures or calling or whatever. If not this, what makes problems intermittent?
Yeah, so definitely high usage during special events can be a contributor to degraded service, not just from cellular, but even from other forms of internet that people might have at home. So during peak times, it might be a little bit slower. Maybe in the middle of the night, it might be a little bit faster just because there's less people using it. So you get a little bit more of the bandwidth that's available for everyone. So yeah, those peak times when you have a lot of people in one place can be a challenge. A lot of organizations actually really work very hard to try to accommodate that. One thing I think about is sports stadiums, where they actually may install additional cellular equipment actually within stadiums just to be able to meet the demand, not just for cellular, but also for Wi-Fi. And, you know, it costs quite a bit of money to in order to be able to do that. So that when you do have, let's say, 20, 30,000 people in one very small area, all trying to Instagram their favorite moment, that it all functions. So yeah, I would probably think that it did contribute to the slower service. There also could be a variety of other things we're uncertain of, whether there were simply hardware issues at that time, uses from other locations. In the end, everything connects to something. Yeah. So there could be a variety of bottlenecks also just to other internet resources, maybe not just for the internet in general, but maybe to specific resources. So specific websites could have been a little bit bottlenecked as well. So I would probably think that would be my interpretation. It's probably the event. There's a lot of people using it. Things might be a little bit sluggish. There could be a variety of other things in that case, but usually they do a pretty good job of surveying and hopefully identifying those slow times where they can offset that traffic.
Let's take some calls. Rick in Door County, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I apologize if you covered this. I've been in and out of the shop, but you were just talking about Office 365, and my question deals with just how secure is the data. I think the default is that it stores to the cloud. Do you want to put a lot of important information out there, or how secure is it?
It's a great question. And I think my answer here would not just apply to Microsoft's Office, but pretty much any cloud solution. So especially with cloud storage, if you're storing things really somewhere that's not your computer, the things I think about is, do I have a backup of that data? So outside of just somebody accessing it, if there's a failure, even on Microsoft's end or a different cloud provider's end, do I have another backup copy? The security of the data, so no one can get into it and read that information. It comes down to one of my favorite topics, which is multi-factor authentication. So the biggest barrier for somebody else being able to access that information in the cloud is being able to protect your account password, and really how you're proving you are who you say you are. So I'll always recommend turn on multi-factor authentication. A variety of different people have noted just how much that reduces the likelihood somebody's going to break into your account, even just making it a little bit more challenging for a bad actor, can just make them, you know, a little bit annoyed enough to move somewhere else. And maybe that's really what you're looking for, not to have perfect security, but good enough so no one's going to try to break into your account for a very long period of time. So enable multi-factor authentication. That should at least minimize the chances that somebody could break in. And if you are using multi-factor, I always recommend using an authenticator application. So maybe it's the Google Authenticator. Maybe it's the Microsoft Authenticator. I actually like the Microsoft Authenticator because it prompts you on your mobile device when you're trying to log in. That can actually be a really great indicator for you. So if somebody's trying to break into your account and just happens to get your password, if you get an indication that you need to allow a login and you're not trying to log in at that time, it's a great indicator somebody has my password. You can still hit deny and make sure they can't get in, but you at least have a better idea of what's going on with your account when you have it. So turn on multi-factor. If you did want to further protect your data, let's even just to say so Microsoft can't read it, there are a variety of things you can do with certain documents to either encrypt or password protect them. So, for example, the Office Suite does have the capability of password protecting and encrypting files that you are using within Office. You can do that and then upload it to, let's say, OneDrive if you're using the kind of the cloud storage mechanism within Office. So that'll allow at least a little bit of extra security, but you can also use third-party encryption programs to encrypt those documents as well. So there's a lot you can do just to make sure that your data stays available. So keep your own local or maybe secondary backup with a different cloud provider. Turn on multi-factor authentication to limit the likelihood somebody can break into your account. And then if you want to go that extra step, make sure your cloud provider can't read it by encrypting it before you even store it there. So use those options within Office or a third-party program to actually encrypt it and then send it up. I usually don't feel the need to do the full encryption unless it's extremely sensitive. Having multi-factor and having an app that I know will prompt me if somebody does manage to guess my password is usually a pretty good indicator for me that my account's secure and that the data up there, hopefully, you know, no one else is looking at. Maybe Microsoft, but, you know, they kind of, you give an element of trust to the provider that you're going with. If you choose not to trust them, which, you know, is a valid point, you can find other ways to secure that as well.
Rick, thank you so much. Let's turn to Margaret in La Crosse. Hi, Margaret.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is, when I turn on my computer and open Chrome, I keep getting this pop-up encouraging me to go and try Microsoft Edge. And I wanted to know if there's been any feedback on that, I'm going to call it an application. I hesitate to do, you know, anything that I didn't order myself.
Yeah,
you might be getting pop-ups a couple different ways. So Windows itself might actually be basically saying, hey, by the way, you want to use Edge. We're Microsoft. We come with this new browser called Edge, which actually is a great browser, especially in comparison to Internet Explorer. If you're happy using Chrome, I would kind of ignore the message and just keep on using Chrome. I am always a little bit leery of any pop-up when I'm getting it, just to know, is there an issue? For example, with Chrome, is it coming from Windows? Is there something wrong with my computer? If you do think Chrome is working fine, you're still getting those pop-ups. One thing you can do within Windows, you can go to a program called Default Apps. Usually you can just type it in the Start menu, and you will find in System Settings a program called Default Apps, and it will show you a listing of the main programs you use in your computer. So it might be your email application, which could be Outlook. It could be Thunderbird. It could be, you know, whatever email application you're using. But it'll also have an option for web browser, which it may have set as Edge, or it might have it set as Chrome. You might find that maybe it's set as Internet Explorer, it might be set as Edge, and you can actually change that to Chrome, which might remove that pop-up. So I take all your default apps just to make sure what that setting is. It does sound like you do want to use Chrome, so I just make sure that your default web browser is set to Chrome. If you do continue to get the pop-ups, the only other thing I'd be interested in is whether there is anything, maybe a plugin in the browser, that even though, you know, Google might be great, you can still download bad plugins. Maybe there's a plugin in Chrome that's giving you that pop-up as well. So you can take a look at your Chrome extensions to see if there's anything unusual there. You'll usually find that in the drop-down menu, and you can go to settings. Otherwise, there's usually a little extensions button that kind of looks like a little puzzle piece. So click on the puzzle piece, click on manage extensions. That'll also tell you what third-party extensions you might have running. If you see something that doesn't look familiar, go ahead and remove it. Otherwise, I guess if you keep on getting it, my next level of paranoia would be, is there adware or spyware on my computer, which is, I think would be doubtful to tell me to use Edge, but you can run super anti-spyware or SpyBot Search and Destroy, or even your antivirus program. Windows Defender comes built in. You might be able to run that as well. There have been some reports of malware actually coming out that have been hiding as an internet or a Microsoft Edge update. So you might say, hey, by the way, update Edge now. Some of those have actually been malware. So just make sure that your computer doesn't have any malware on your device, and you can look at virus and threat protection. That's also in system settings. Make sure your virus and threat protection is turned on, and go ahead and run a full scan just to make sure you don't have anything weird going there.
There you go, Margaret. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGrue, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Callers online, Lowe, Jim, and Bob, we'll get to you for sure. But we are going to take a look now at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the through the afternoon. I'm Larry Mueller, and tell you what, Jesse LeGrue and I will be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at technology on the show today with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrue. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Jesse, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Callers online, so let's go to the phones and talk to Lowe first in Milwaukee. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about Yahoo. In that, on my cell phone, the sign-on page never recognizes me. Almost every time I move from a computer, one of our Microsoft laptops, I can access Yahoo there. But every time I use my iPhone, I have to reinsert the passcode, and it doesn't always like the passcode I'm using. I'm wondering what option I have.
One thing I'd probably recommend for the account, and this can be similar for a lot of other accounts as well, Microsoft, I've seen it for Dropbox and a lot of other cloud services. They'll have an option to basically remember the device that you're using. So is this a device that you trust so you don't necessarily have to log in or type in a code every single time? One thing you might be able to do on your device, if you are using it for email, and it is something, you know, a little bit newer, I might actually recommend just removing the account and then adding it back to your device, just to have it go through the sign-in process from scratch, and then allow you to get in. It may or may not have an option for I choose to kind of trust this device in the future, meaning that you may not have to type in a code every time. Another challenge with the cell phone is it might be moving in between your cellular data network and your Wi-Fi network. So it almost looks like you're kind of moving locations very quickly, and maybe the Yahoo service is flagging that for whatever reason. But setting it up from scratch might help. That is the only immediate recommendation I have for kind of the repeated prompts. If you are using multi-factor authentication, if for whatever reason it doesn't accept the code for that authentication, it's usually a timeout issue, or it only accepts that code from one device within a certain period. So I've seen this with other services where I'm signing into two devices. For one device, I type in my code, but maybe for another browser or another device, I have to authenticate to the same service. I need to wait actually a minute to get a new code to type it into that that other box. That may or may not be the case for yours, but I have seen it if you are kind of logging in a very short period with different devices to the same service. I don't have a Yahoo account that I'm currently using, but I know Microsoft does have like a login center where you can see different sign-ins. You might be able to look through your security settings and your Yahoo account using a web browser, probably on your desktop, to see if it does have a setting to kind of either trust your mobile device or even to look at other devices signing into your account, just in case it might actually be related to somebody trying to break into it. But usually you're able to see it through your sign-in history when logged in directly to your Yahoo account on a browser, on a desktop. And I do say a desktop just because it's hard to look at usually on a mobile device. They tend to have a lot of settings and they just tend to be web-driven. So it's not something you'd see if you're using like the Android email app or the Mail app for iOS. You just don't see the same things unless you're on that website.
There you go, Lo. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jim in Green Bay. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon. I have Apple desktops and HP desktops and Apple phone. And I would like to activate the Word on all of them so that if I use Word and save something in one, it would be saved on all. How would I do that?
That's a good question. What I would actually use in this case, there's a few different ways to do it. Since you are using two Apple devices, one option that kind of comes built in is iCloud. So iCloud is usually turned on and available directly in your preferences from your Mac in addition to your iOS device, whether it's, you know, an iPad or an iPhone. I would actually store everything in iCloud, which will at least synchronize it between those two devices. On your Windows PC, you'll also need to install the iCloud app. So you can download that directly from Apple and install it on your PC. And as long as you are saving things in that iCloud area, you'll be able to access it from all three locations relatively easily. Usually the biggest challenge is just remembering how to save it to iCloud. I kind of have this issue when I use my iOS device because you have different areas where you can save things to, and just making sure that you're saving it on iCloud and knowing how to navigate that might take a second or two, especially on a mobile device. It's usually relatively straightforward when you're using like a desktop because it looks kind of a little bit more traditional, like a folder you're storing it to. iCloud's a great option. You do have a limit on storage. You can purchase additional storage as well. You can also use other third-party options if you want to. If you do, for example, use Office and have Microsoft services, you can also potentially use OneDrive, and you can actually use OneDrive on your Mac, OneDrive on your iOS device, and OneDrive on your PC. You'd just be installing a different application. But iCloud, at least by default, comes on two of your three devices. Yeah. So that's one of the easiest ways to go. Otherwise, OneDrive might be an option if you're using Office already and have a subscription. Another option, which has been really popular, is Dropbox. And Dropbox works on all of those devices as well and can do similar synchronization, but you need to install the app. So iCloud's the first place to go to if you're interested in doing it, but you do have options.
Good luck, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Bob in Decorah, Iowa next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a problem here. I have an i7 that I use for photography and business and a little bit of the internet. And then I also have an i7 I use for gaming and looking on the internet too. On the i7, I had a corrupt program and I had to reboot the whole system. And then a funny thing happened. The internet, they were both using They're both using Microsoft Edge, and they're both remembering the history on both computers. If I use it on one, it'll show it on the other. Is there a program that I could turn off so this won't happen over?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, and this is a feature for a lot of modern browsers these days. So Chrome, Firefox, Edge all have these, what they call synchronization features that allow you to basically keep all your settings, including even just what you're browsing at the time, synchronized between multiple devices, which for a usability standpoint can be really easy. But if you want to segregate your life on different devices, can make it really, really tricky. So what you would do, at least on your, and it does depend on your browser because you can do it in multiple browsers. When you go to your, let's say it's Microsoft Edge, usually near the top right-hand corner, you'll find your user account. It'll note your own settings. You can go to options. It'll have an option to turn off or turn on sync. In your case, you probably want to turn off sync, and you can manage other settings. If you are doing this with Chrome or Firefox, it's actually very similar, where if you signed in using Chrome or Firefox, either you can just log out of the browser, which means it won't be available anymore, or you can turn off those synchronization features. So really what you're looking for is turn off sync, and you might have different options if you're using different browsers, but that should allow you to have unique settings between the two. If you want to make sure you're not synchronizing either one of them, you'll want to sign out or disable the synchronization features for both of them. The synchronization feature too, if you do have it turned on, it means it has to be stored somewhere. So it's likely if you're using a Microsoft account, it's being stored in Microsoft somewhere. Maybe you don't want that going to Microsoft, so it can be saving those settings. If that's the case, you know, turn off synchronization. You might even want to completely log out of your account on your browser so that it's not being sent to Microsoft as well. That could also be said for the other options for Chrome, Firefox, and probably many other browsers out there that have that synchronization feature.
Good luck, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Roger in Grantsburg, it's your turn. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, not tomatoes. Yeah, I was my garden guy. We got a problem here. Everything in the house, we got all the, I don't know how many different TVs. They're all Roku, so they're all Wi-Fi. And it's like our Wi-Fi, I guess, the box. I got a new router, and then I was going to try to put a Wi-Fi booster in, but I could not figure out how to get it to work with my router. It's a Netgear router, and there's just not enough signal strength. Do I have to put in a bigger router, or is there a moron-friendly Wi-Fi a booster that you can put on without having to be an IT guy like you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so for your Netgear, there's a couple of things I'd look at first. One, Netgear may have an add-on for a wireless extender that's relatively easy for the existing router that you have. One reason I say look into that is because you already have an investment for your current router. So if you have an easy add-on, that would be great. Really what you're looking for here to kind of get your solution to really have wireless cover a larger geographical area in your house. You know, maybe it's because you just have walls in the way, like we all do, or just a larger amount of space from point A to point B. You're looking to basically set up a wireless mesh system. And so if you're looking at wireless devices, that really is the key term, is mesh. And this is really installing more than one access point to really give you a distributed network throughout a larger area. And this is, you know, really needed more often because you have multi-level houses. You simply might have obstructions between the walls that actually just cause issues with the signal being able to flow from one area to the other. And so if you can have an add-on access point for your Netgear system, that's great. Otherwise, if you were able to, you know, look kind of from scratch at a wireless mesh system, most of them come built in to do everything, including the routing aspect, where you basically would plug it in where your Netgear router is today. And then you can just simply add on these other little units wherever you might need in your house to boost that signal. Depending on where that, you know, your existing internet connection is, you may need one more or you may need two more different add-on access points. Actually making a little map of your house in kind of 2D, just to see here's where my room is here, here's where I'm trying to get my wireless, might help you indicate I can't get from here to here because it's too far away. I might need another one in the middle just to help bridge that distance. But yeah, you're going to want a mesh system. You might be able to add on to your Netgear. I would look at Netgear's information for or manual even for your existing router and just search for mesh in the manual. You might find a nice add-on where they say, hey, add this to create a mesh wireless network at home. And then you might just be able to buy that. Otherwise, there are a lot of great wireless mesh systems out there that you can get that are going to suit your need. I always recommend, you know, take a look at the reviews, make sure you're also getting something that is reputable and is going to work for you. Usually, you know, something really inexpensive you might have other challenges with. So I do tend to look at reviews and see what other people are saying about it. But that mesh system is going to help you. It's going to give you that greater coverage. You're likely not just going to see, you know, that things are working, but things might actually just be working better in general.
Good luck, Roger. Thank you so much. Carl in Eagle River, we'll go to you next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'll be brief. I have two computers. One's about 5 years old, one's about seven. Both have Windows 10, and I have fiber optic service at my house, wireless, both of those computers. And if I'm watching a YouTube video and I just want to close the browser and walk away, I click on the red box on the top right-hand side, and it might be 10 seconds before I go back to my desktop, and I can still hear some of the audio. It takes another 5-6 seconds before the audio's done. What's going on?
Slow switch.
And that really is a delay from really Windows being able to clean up and properly close the application. So even as you click on the red X and it's closing everything out, it really has to take some work and end a lot of different processes on your computer. So more or less, it's really a speed issue. It might be exaggerated a bit if you have more tabs open. So the more memory intensive or the more power, whatever you're doing, is required, the more likely you're going to have that lag between you click on something and then you actually get the behavior. And I've seen this before. It does happen. There may not be a whole lot you can do with it, but I would also take a look at any plugins you might have for your browser or anything running in the background on your system. It could just be something else is taking up some processing or memory resources that's making that not be as responsive as you'd like it to be. So you can speed that up by hopefully giving it some more resources by closing other things out. I think that some of the programs I mentioned before, super anti-spyware, SpyBot, Search and Destroy, they tend to find adware or software you don't want running in the background. That could be taking up resources you really don't want to use. Another option to try, you could also try a different browser to see if the behavior is different. I think in this case, if you're using Edge, it's based off of Chromium. And it should have a variety of similar features to other popular browsers, but it could be something to take a look at. Maybe it's just something about YouTube that's causing an issue, but another browser might give you a little bit different response, but it's likely going to be a resource thing. There might be limited things you can do, but those are a few things to try.
Thanks, Carl. Appreciate your call. Tom in Mequonigo, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Good. I have a little bit of a different question for you. We we had a photo studio, so we downsized last year from a pretty big, good-sized operation, which means I have a lot of, like, Macintosh. I've got those really nice enclosures for Macintosh, the aluminum ones. Prior to the workstations being the little round ones, you know, I had this. Is there any way to upgrade those to a more modern system so they can, you know, can you get new motherboards for them or any sort of upgrade? Because they're just wonderful enclosures. It's just that they're outdated. I think I have some G5s yet.
Yeah.
Oh, So my initial reaction is probably going to be no, because Apple would require, you know, they usually have a different layout. All the ports are going to be a little bit different. There might be something third party, although I haven't looked into it. I know there are companies that do modifications or mods to basically, you know, create tablets, which is one of the popular things. Apple really didn't have a tablet solution, so you could actually purchase a modification for a laptop, ship it off to somebody, and they'd basically build you a tablet out of it. There might be some of those options, but otherwise it's really, really limited. There's not a whole lot you can do outside of simply replacing the device. If you do want to install Mac OS on the device, it also does need to be Apple supported hardware. Really the way to get Apple supported hardware is to buy it from Apple. And at least to my knowledge, Apple doesn't have an option to utilize old cases to put in new equipment. So you're kind of limited in your options there.
Tom, thank you. Pat in Wabasha can't seem to get her Google Chrome to use a new copy of a printer program. She can't find where in Chrome to delete the old link to the printer and substitute the new link.
For Chrome or any browser, if you're looking to print something, usually it's going to be using your settings with your operating system. So whether that's, let's say, Mac OS or it's Windows. So I would go to your preferences if you're using a Mac, or go to your printers and devices within Windows. Look for the printers that are displayed there. Either delete or add the printer that you would like. And you might need to close your browser and open it back up. But as soon as that's updated on your system, it should be updated in your browser. But it's all reading your settings from your operating system. So that's where you'll need to update it. Otherwise, check your extensions and see if you might see anything unusual there.
Always a pleasure, Jesse. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I look forward to your next visit. Appreciate
so
it. Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He'll be back, and we'll do this again with him. Just looking ahead, tomorrow we have a list of children's books to recommend for you at 11. Then at 11:45, we'll check in with a travel expert to find out what's going on with airline delays. That's tomorrow, starting at 11. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.